Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blog News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with someone from the entertainment world. My guest today is a singer-songwriter. I'm very pleased to welcome Tokio Rosenthal. Tok, it's been a while since we talked. It's great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's great to talk to you, too. I feel like it was yesterday, but it was really quite a while.
Right. In fact, as I recall, the last time we got together on the radio, it was right before your album Ghosts was released. How are people enjoying Ghosts?
I've got to say, can I put humble aside and just talk straight up if I can? I don't want to brag, but like right out of the box, the album hit number 5 on the Euro Americana charts, which was in the world of Americana, which is my genre, of course, is quite a thing, and I was very pleased with that and real happy with the response. The album had 2 singles, Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression, and had a single called And Then You Sang, and Then You Sang hit number 2 on the Hot Disc chart, which is primarily based in Europe and in Australia, believe it or not. One of these days I'll save up enough money to tour there. And the other one was Mr. Great, Tell Me About the Great Depression, hit number 2 on the NBT chart, and NBT standing for Next Best Thing. So it was, you know, a nice response, and I've had the opportunity to be touring quite a bit since the release of the album and seeing people throughout the U.S. And the U.K. And getting to play the songs live and kind of getting the reaction from the fans who are coming out to the shows that telling me that they like Ghosts and actually bringing copies for me to autograph, which was a lot of fun. You know, I said, because what happens is we have radio promotion guys that work for Rock and Sock Records. One in particular, Brad Hunt. Hi, Brad, if you're listening, he's been great. And you get these reports that say where your music is playing on radio. But it's kind of like the old expression, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody hears it, did it really fall? It's kind of like, I don't hear the songs on the radio because they're playing in places where I don't live. And so when I really go there and play a club in one of those markets and people show up and I say, well, how do you know about my music? And they go, oh, well, I heard you on WNCW or WGWG. And it's like, I'm like, oh, I guess they really are playing my music. And, of course, I get the BMI residual checks, so that's nice, too.
Yeah, right. Don't spend them all at once.
No, they're not that big, unfortunately.
I'm interested in the comment that you made about, you know, getting play and recognition in Europe and as far away as Australia. I talk to a lot of musicians, and I kind of hear the same thing. You know, British musicians will say, oh, well, I don't do so good in Britain, but, you know, I do great in Poland. You know? I've never been able to figure it out.
I think all I can talk about is, you know, for a U.S. artist or an Americana artist in particular, there seems to be just a greater appreciation for, on a broader base, for Americana music in England, Scotland, Ireland, Holland, Belgium, and Germany. Those are kind of like the key ones, at least they have been for me. Australia, for sure. Canada to some extent, but it's just that one, you know, it's when you go any place where you are the exotic person, so to speak, if you go to, you know, if an American goes to Europe, you're exotic. If a European comes to the U.S., they're exotic because you're different. But I just think over here we're just more prone also to not being as open to new things. Our radio is very much playlist oriented. It's hard to break in. There's not that many Americana stations. Internet radio, like we're on right now, is just really starting to get the attention of Americans, where Europeans and Australians, for that matter, too, are much hipper to the Internet and Internet radio and listening to it. I think that they've been much more the leaders in that area. So they're more open to different kinds of music and different people, and they're just much more progressive where Internet radio is concerned.
One of the reasons that I like the Internet radio format is the fact that the program is recorded. And so, you know, as a radio host, I really don't concern myself so much about the live listeners.
Right.
In my view, the real value is in the recording. You know, 2 years from now, someone can say, "Oh, this sounds like an interesting program."
Well, I agree with you 100%, because I've actually gotten emails from people that have said, "Hey, you know, I heard you on Simon Barrett the other day," and I'm like, "The other day?" I said, "Well, I did that interview 6 months ago," and they would say, "Oh, yeah, but it was archived, and we listened to it over there," and there's other people, because I try to be as up to date on my own website with keeping links and stuff on there, and and if you Google Tokyo Rosenthal, you know, if you whatever page it'll come up on, it'll say, oh, you know, Blogger News Network's, you know, Simon Barrett, you know, it'll have the interviews, or it'll say Tokyo Rosenthal on WGWG or whatever, wherever there happens to be archiving. And, I agree with you. It just gives, there's more longevity to it. It's, you know, the whole, let's face it, the whole map is changing, you know?
It certainly is. You mentioned Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression. Just by a huge coincidence, I don't know how this happened. I'm looking in my music archive on Blog Talk Radio, and I just happen to have found it. Would you like to listen to it?
Let's listen to it, and I can give you, when we get done, I'll tell you a little bit about how the audiences have been reacting to the live version of it.
Okay.
Play away.
So here is Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression.
There wasn't no place to hide, no place to sit out the ride. Seems like we hadn't learned our lesson. Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression. It all on war and oil, put our heads in the mortgage soil, enjoy the free lunch and ask for a pension. Mister, tell me about the Great Depression. Did we really start that war? About the Great Depression. Great Depression. Tell me, tell me, tell me, tell me, tell me. Tell me, tell me, tell me, tell me. I heard a rumor that could have cured that tumor. Mister, tell me about the Great Depression.
Can't resist. So, Mr. Rosenthal, tell me about the Great Depression.
Well, first of all, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that that's the great Bobby Britt on fiddle on that track, and he's just a pleasure to play with, and he was on part of my tour this year too, so it's just great going out and playing with him. It's what I love to do with live audiences when I play that song. I usually introduce it by saying, gee, have you read the papers lately? And everybody kind of gives me this blank stare because nobody's reading newspapers anymore anyway. But then I say, well, or online, you know, any kind of, however you get your news source, have you noticed that they told us that the recession is over? And everybody goes, I said, well, do you believe that? You know, let's take a vote. How many people believe the recession is over? And, of course, nobody claps. And then how many think we're still going on? Okay, how many people think it's actually a depression and the whole place goes crazy? You know, it's like, so I usually get them riled up like that. I said, well, I'm of the firm belief that not only is it still going on, but that it's a depression. And then, you know, I proceed from there. And you like to know that you're connecting with the audience. And that song, as you know, 100% of the time out there, I got to say, especially with what's going on, not just over here, but overseas too, because England isn't just, their economy is just as bad. Ireland, and I was up in Scotland, and you know, they appreciate the song just as much. It was funny too. I just played a club recently in Charlotte, North Carolina, a really great place called the Evening Muse. And I did, you know, did my normal show and did Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression. And the next day on Facebook, there was this guy, I probably shouldn't say his name on the air, but anyway, he had this thing on there talking about, he had been in the audience, somebody who I didn't know, and then subsequently had joined my fan page on there, and said how moved he was by this song that Tokio Rosenthal did last night called Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression. And he went and found a live video version of it that's on YouTube from a radio station that I had been a guest on, and then he posted that. And I said, well, I connected. So it makes you feel good, you know? So,
but there was at least one person that bought your CD that night.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. He was the one. Okay, I didn't put that together. Now the one that I sold must have been him. Okay, no, yeah. He just left his money by the box there, yeah.
Actually, I was kind of joking there, but on a more serious note, do you sell CDs when you, when you play?
Yes, I do. I'm not a big fan of doing that, though. It's kind of funny. I do it under duress. I still come from the generation where you go to see a live act and then you go to the record store the next day and buy the record. The problem is there's no CD stores anymore. So it's that one extra step. I mean, everybody's either downloading or, you know, they could buy hard copies of my CDs at various places, and they could, you know, if they really, you know, want to, they could find it in some store where the stores still exist. So I don't like, you know, really hawking my wares at shows, but so I kind of do it, you know, very subtly. I've got a stand that's got my CDs in it with a little poster that says the price and that we don't have any shipping charge because they're right there. And sometimes I'll break into the old Marx Brothers routine. Well, there's a shipping charge from me to you, and how about if I move over here? Well, then I'll move closer to you. You know, one of those routines, if you've seen that movie from the Marx Brothers, Chico and Groucho, do a great routine about that. But it's I'm getting off the subject. But I, you know, I put them out there, and I don't get aggressive about it. I don't walk around from table to table. They're there, and I'm much more flattered when I get sales that way, because I don't feel like I'm in somebody's face making them buy my CD, and I just want them to be able to get it, so that's the way it is.
Yeah, I think you know, the modern musician has to have their CDs available there and then, because you're right. You know, the days of the old record store are long gone. You know, I look back to my youth, which was many, many years ago. You know, and I'd have my wallet full of money. Well, full. I'd have a couple of dollars in it. You know, and I'd truck off to the record store. And back in those days, they had this sort of delightful system where, you know, you could browse the album covers. Oh, now I'm really dating myself.
Well, but those were great times, and you had somebody in the store who actually knew what the merchandise was, and could talk music with you. And now, you know, I don't want to go buy a CD at Best Buy.
Right. You know, you'd walk up to the counter with an album cover, and you'd say, "I'd love to listen to this." And they'd have little listening booths, you know, and you could listen to a couple of tracks. You know, they put it on the turntable.
how about this though? The worst thing though, and I've seen this, and I've actually been pitched it by companies, is there are artists. I like to have and most people I talk to like to have something physically in their hands about the musician while they're listening to his music, a picture of him, the liner notes, just something that you're holding. It's not quite as good as the vinyl days, but, you know, I'll take it. It's a CD, comes with a booklet or something like that. And so it's good when they buy a hard copy version of a CD from me, but there's actually musicians out there who bring what we call download cards. Have you seen these, Simon?
Sort of, and I'll be honest, I do not like them.
Oh, me neither. They're and I'm like, how could you? That's like, how much more impersonal can it get? It's like, by the way, if you like my act, I'll sell you a download card, which is about, you know, I don't even know how to tell you, it's the size of a credit card, that's what you're coming home from the gig with. You put a download card. It's like, that's terrible.
So. I was talking to a musician a few days ago, a guy by the name of Jamie Michaels. He's a really, really great singer-songwriter and very much in the same genre as you are. And, you know, he has a new single out, and it's available on iTunes. Or it's available, you know, on CD, and it has a real sleeve, you know, and a real picture and some real notes on the back. And I was saying to him, you know, well, number one, I don't own anything. But even if I did, I want something I can hold in my hand.
Right.
Yep. So you... Since you released Ghosts, you've been doing some traveling. Where have you been touring?
Well, a lot. Almost immediately after the album came out, we hit England and Scotland and New York City, which was I got to play a place twice this year in New York, which was a place that I actually grew up with as well, as somebody, a place that I attended and I was actually a fan and saw some great music at, called The Bitter End. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of it. It's been around since the 60s. Everybody from Dylan on down has played there.
It sounds like a folk place, and it sounds like it has a nautical flavor.
Well, I don't know about the nautical part, but definitely the Volk Place. It's down in the village on Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village and has been there for, you know, I guess, 40 years. And to get to play there and headline there was like, you know, great for me. I can't tell you what it meant. So I got to play there the first time. Actually, the first time I was scheduled was was shortly after Ghost had come out. I think it was in February, and the show got snowed out. There was like a flash blizzard in New York, which was very disappointing. Then it got rescheduled for April, and I got to play there in April as part of a ongoing Northeast tour, and it was just terrific because I was originally brought up on, I grew up on Long Island, so still had a lot of friends and fans out there, and they pretty much packed the place and made it just a fantastic experience. We recorded that show, as well as another Bitter End show I just did about a month ago. And maybe somewhere down the line we're talking about putting out a live album from the Bitter End, because the recordings came out pretty good. I've been touring with a guy named Charlie Chamberlain, who's just fantastic. He's been a godsend to me. He's plays both mandolin and lead guitar, so we've been out doing that. But back to your original question, we hit England, Scotland, the Northeast. I got to make my Nashville debut this year. I'd never played Nashville before, believe it or not. I played a really nice club there called 12th and Porter. Hit the South, too. Played down in Knoxville and Greenville and Charlotte and Roanoke. And I'm sure I'm leaving out some towns, so please don't get mad at me, towns, if you're listening. It's just been, you know, one steady thing, and we're ending, you know, my agent obviously has a sense of humor because I'm ending my year's tour in Canada this weekend.
Yes, and I'm going to be coming to that later in the interview.
Okay. So it's been you know, a lot of fun getting out there, and it's kind of been nonstop, but good nevertheless.
All right, I'm still firmly convinced that the Bitter End has a nautical flavor, and the reason is it's a nautical term about ropes, and not all ropes are created equal, and there is a bitter end. Yeah, so there you go. Yeah, that's today's piece of useless trivia from Simon Barrett. does traveling get old, living out of a suitcase?
I'd like to say that it doesn't, but it does. Really, for a couple of reasons. One, I'm a family man, so I miss my family. You know, my wife sometimes gets to come out on tour with me, but more often than not doesn't. So it's good to get back home to her. My kids have grown up, but the fun part was they both live in New York City, so Daddy got to stay with them when he played the Bitter End in their apartment because they share an apartment. I get out for about 10 days, and that's sort of like my limit. By the time I get to the 10th day, it's like, okay, I'm ready to come home. So I try to stagger the tours where I go out for a week or 10 days, and then I'm home for a while, even if it's just a week, and then go back out. I think if, you know, I see some of these musicians who go out on a tour, and they're out for like 2 or 3 months at a time, and I don't know how they do it. That's just a long time to just be on the road and living out of a suitcase. And I'm like, I don't even like to do a wash when I'm on the road. If I'm gone for 14 days, I bring 14 pairs of socks, 14 pairs of underwear, 14 T-shirts. Nothing gets washed. It all gets moved over to the dirty side of the suitcase. But, you know, but it's, so when I run out of clothes, the tour's over. That's how it works. That's the other reason. See, if I had more socks, the tours would be longer. But I only have 14 pairs of socks, and that's, so I can't tour more than 2 weeks.
Actually, it was several years ago, probably 6 or 7 years ago, I somehow somehow ended up at a Herman Hermits concert.
Peter Noon.
The old, yes, the very same. Actually, the only remaining member is the drummer. And after the gig, I had the opportunity to chat with him for, I don't know, 5 minutes or so. And, yeah, they were playing at that time something like 250 gigs a year.
Yeah.
All right, they didn't even know where home was. And you know, but that was their life. They'd been doing it.
No, well, you literally. I mean, people say, "Gee, I woke up and I didn't know where I was," and that sounds like an old cliche. But it's not an old cliche. It's really, you wake up some mornings in a particular hotel room and you're not sure exactly where you're at. You know, it's like, oh yeah, now what city am I? What day is it? You know, you really don't know. The amazing thing for me is the songs also start to take on. You write them about one thing, and then midway through the tour, they take on a totally different meaning. You know, they have, you know, they change.
Right.
I had that. I'll tell you. I got to tell you this story. This is in retrospect, it's become a funny story, but it's I was minding my own business a couple of months ago, and my doctor informs me that I have a disease called temporal arthritis. Now I assume you probably never heard of this disease. I'd never heard of this disease, so I said to him, "Well, what is it?" And he says, "What's going to happen to me?" He says, "Well, it's a fairly serious disease. You're going to go blind, and then you're going to die." And I said, "Oh," I said, "but you have the cure for me, don't you?" He says, "Well, yes, I do." And I said, "Okay, tell me what the cure is." And he had these steroids that, you know, were like incredible. That he was going to give me this I think it was called prednisone, you know, which could, you know, have me hitting home runs and pitching for the Yankees or something like that. And I said, "So if I take these steroids, everything's going to be okay, right?" And he said, yeah. He said, "No problem. You got to be on them for about, I don't know, 2 months." Oh, then he said, "Oh, but possibly a year." And I said, "Oh, okay." He says, "But you don't want to go blind?" And I said, "No." And then I got home that night. I mean, well, the thought about it, and I said, well, you know, blind musicians, you know, blind Tokyo Rosenthal had a nice ring to it, but I was like, I was like, you know, do I go out on tour with Stevie Wonder or something? You know, I don't want to get too politically correct here.
How would you get matching socks?
Yeah, there you go. That's another reason. But I got home that night, and I'm all set to take the steroids, and then it hit me. If I took the steroids and music journalists like yourself ever found out that I was taking steroids, I'd never get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They would say, "Oh, he's juicing. That's it. You know, that now we know how he played all of those songs. He was like on steroids." I mean, look what happened in baseball. You know, it's like Mark McGwire and all these guys aren't getting into the Hall of Fame because they were on steroids. And I figured, okay, if they find out that I was on steroids, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will never let me in. So, but then I relented and I took the steroids, only to find out, by the way, that I was misdiagnosed. I can't make this stuff up. This is all true. Two weeks into taking the steroids, I find out that they misdiagnosed me. Turns out, by the way, as a side note, that I had Lyme disease, which is a whole other. We have to do that on a different show. When the new album comes out, we'll talk about Lyme disease. But it was like, so, you know, and I'm out on tour while all of this is going on, too. And it was just absolute craziness. My eyesight came back really good eventually. But I was driving, you can appreciate this, I'm driving on tour in England and Scotland on the wrong side of the road, what we call the wrong side of the road. It's tough enough to do that. And I'm doing it where my eyesight's not all that good. And Charlie Chamberlain is like freaking out and saying, "Please, Toke, let me drive." "No, I'm fine. I can do this, you know."
Right.
He says, "But you're in the wrong lane." I said, "Oh, well, that's okay, you know." So, but it you know, so that we have the song off the Ghost album called "There Is No Perfect Love." And the opening line of it is, "My day of reckoning has come." So that song took on a whole different meaning for that tour. So.
I know that this is going to absolutely amaze you, and it will amaze the people listening in, but I just happen to have that song queued up.
Unbelievable. What a lead-in.
Yeah, right.
You would think that we've done this before.
Well, I have to admit that I had no clue where you were going with this story. this is not a put-on job. This has not been rehearsed.
Well, this comes from a year. It comes from a year of touring, though. I know how to set up the material.
Okay. Well, why don't we listen to "There Is No Perfect Love"?
Sounds like a good idea.
My day of reckoning has come, the eve of my destruction. Now it's your turn to judge. There is no perfect love. So this is how we turn 33. Bells and cut, you see me now. See me fall from the pedestal above. There is no perfect love. Wanna know why? You wanna know why? Just like I need fresh air to breathe, you fill me up, but the web I weave has me caught as you say it leaves. Take me back,
without the fiddle. How does that work?
Well, sometimes I play without fiddle. This tour, there's been like, I call it the four Tokyo Rosenthal bands. There's the solo Tokyo Rosenthal, which not my favorite thing to do. I obviously it's a lot more fun.
You got no one to blame but yourself.
Exactly. Then there's the tour, because most of the time I go out as a duo. it's rare that we actually get to play as a three piece or a four piece out there on the road. It's just very difficult, you know, to economically and otherwise to get everybody together. So sometimes I do go out with just myself and the fiddle player Bobby Britt, who you just heard. So when he's there, then there's no problem playing that song because he's playing the fiddle. Charlie Chamberlain plays mandolin on that song, and he plays it so good that you don't miss the fiddle. That's how good he plays mandolin. And then I've got another lead guitar player, a young kid that I found down here in Chapel Hill named Warren Sharp, who's been out doing dates with me as well, because Charlie moved to New Hampshire, so he can't do the local dates. Warren's been playing the local dates, and he's got this great picking style. And again, when Warren's playing that solo, you know, you're not thinking about the fiddle, you're watching Warren. So the only time you're thinking about the solo is if I'm foolish enough to play that song by myself when I'm out there playing alone. So it's usually, quite frankly, off the set list because of that if I'm out playing solo, and you'll get a different tune.
Right. I'll tell you what, how about we do some shameless commercialization? Where can people buy your albums?
Well, if they would like to, and I hope that they do. Many places. First, the best place to go, though, is to start off is go to my website, which is just TokyoRosenthal.com. Tokyo like the city, Rosenthal like the China.com, one word. And that'll tell you some links where you could get it, like hard copies in particular at CD Baby and at iTunes. You can get all the downloads. Amazon has it. Napster. It has it, fortunately or unfortunately. And FYE stores in the United States. If you're listening in England, HMV, either they have it in the store or they are on the computer to order it for you. So we've got pretty good distribution. So
good Lord, HMV, that's a name I haven't heard in many years.
Yeah, they still exist, you know.
So England actually still has real stores.
Well, yeah, you know, I wish we had something like even like HMV over here, because they're well stocked. I mean, they're not like as good as Tower was. I mean, I miss Tower terribly. I mean, so much so there is one Tower store left in the world, and it's in, oddly enough, Tokyo, Japan. And when I played Tokyo a couple of years ago, you know, everybody else who was out there on the tour is like, you know, I want to go see this Buddhist temple. I want to go to this. And they were like, where do you want to go? I want to go to the Tower store, you know. and so I spent the day in Tower Records in Tokyo, Japan. And it was like the 7th floor store. And it was so great to be back in Tower Records. But, yeah, they could buy it, buy them anywhere you want. I think I'll be at the flea market on Sunday here in Chapel Hill, settling them out of the trunk of my car, if you want to come down. they're obviously readily available. CD Baby is usually the easiest one to get them at.
Have you ever considered doing a DVD?
Yes. You know, there's if you go on, I guess if you Google me, I think it's on MySpace as well, or Facebook, maybe there's a link to it on Facebook. There's a TV show that I did here called Sessions at Studio B, and that's pretty much me and Charlie doing, I think, 6 or 7 songs in their studio, and there was a studio host. That's about as close to, except for the bootlegs that are all over YouTube of me, that's about as close to a DVD that I've done. That being said, I've never done the quote-unquote rock video. And I'm thinking, you know, I would have loved, you know, in retrospect, and you and I might have talked about this once before, to have had somebody, you know, even if I just hired a college kid to say, you know, give me a video to go along with Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression. I don't necessarily need to be in the video lip-syncing to the song, because I don't, you know, I don't think that really does anything. But I would have loved to have, like, images both of the Depression back in 1929 to 1939, along with images of today's Depression / Recession.
I can see it already. You know,
yeah.
the joining together of you know, black and white clips of the Dust Bowl.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I. No. I should have done. You know, I like I said, in retrospect, I wish I had done that. Yeah, some of the ones that have some storylines to it, you know, there's a song off of One Score and Ten called The Ballad of Doc and Sadie, which ironically, you know, although I wrote the lyrics to it many, many years ago before I ever recorded it, about a guy losing his job and becoming a pot dealer and going down to Mexico to get drugs. And getting caught up in that life, although it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek comical song, it stands up today. It's the lyrics and the storyline could really go. You know, I always pictured, you know, then maybe like, you know, that kind of a thing. But for the new album, I guess what I'm getting at, I got a new record that I'm recording right now, and I'm not going to let this time get by. I'm going to do one or two rock videos because there's a couple of very topical songs on the album, and there's one song that's got like a fascinating story that sort of has to do with an adventure from when I grew up, so to speak. It's almost a crazy story, but you know, I'm thinking that it would really make a great video. I don't really want to do something where it's like, you know, Tokyo Rosenthal starring in the video and again lip syncing to a song, you know, unless there's, you know, I'd like to do like a Hitchcock thing where I make like a cameo in the DVD somewhere.
Sure.
You know, that I just show up, you know, playing a character or something like that, you know, for like 2 seconds. But I don't fancy myself an actor. And you know, a live record's a live, you know, if it's a live DVD, that would be cool, you know. But like I said, there's, you know, there's one of those available right now that's on it's on a thing called Sessions at Studio B from the NBC affiliate down here. So.
Oh, I'm going to have to look that up.
Okay.
Before Ghosts, your previous release was Love One Out, and I thought that was just an excellent album. Indeed, you know, I do think Ghosts is an excellent album, and that kind of surprised me. I you know, listen to a lot of music, and you tend to find that a musician, you know, his best album is going to be album number one, because you know he's taking the very best of the material he has. Album number two, which in your case would be Love One Out, oftentimes doesn't quite meet the same expectations, you know, because they're, you know, the musicians digging deeper into their bag. But that wasn't the case. Love One Out is an absolutely splendid album. In fact, again, you know, you'll be amazed at this. I just happen to have the title track. Do you think we should give it a quick whirl?
Just before you play it, though, I want you to play it with this in mind, that while I've been out touring, I've been playing what we call over here blue states, and I've been playing red states. And the reaction to the song is a lot different in the red states than it is in the blue states, because it's only fair to alert the listeners that this is a pro-gay marriage song. So listen to the lyrics with an open ear and an open heart, and I'll leave you with that.
Okay, here is Love One Out.
where you might have gone, on a level playing field without the shackles on. Learn to fight for your legacy. You know they'll try and blow it out. Using the microchip tools, you learn to school of one out.
I can understand how you might get mixed reactions depending on where you were playing.
Well, I was down in Johnson City, Tennessee, playing a gig there, and solo, I might add, and my wife Carrie was with me, and she's like, well, you know, you don't have to say, you know, because normally I do my little spiel leading into Love Worn Out. That's, you know, my own views on pro-gay marriage. And she goes, you know, you don't have to say that. You can just play the song. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do my little rap. And, of course, I did my rap, and the place turned on me like dogs. They were like – and I got them back, though, because the way I always win them back, if I happen to be in a red state that's not into that, I said, well, look, I don't care what your politics may be, but I think everybody will agree that everyone is entitled to have an equal opportunity to find out just how difficult marriage is. And then the place applauded, and I went on with the song, and everybody agreed with that point of view, if nothing else. So that usually wins them back. So
I think you're the first musician who I've ever heard, you know, talk about, you know, having to figure out the politics of a state before playing a song.
Oh man, you'd be surprised. Even parts of Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression, if they're really listening to the lyrics, you know, because I'm not against the army, but I was certainly, you know, I'm against the war. I was against the war in Iraq, and I'm not a big supporter of what's going on in Afghanistan, so I don't want to, but I'm for our troops. I'm not against that, but, you know, but some of the lyrics in there, especially the part about having stole the election, I'm clearly not talking about the Obama election. I'm talking about Gore and Bush, you know. And so if I'm in a red state and they're really paying attention to the lyrics, it's kind of like keep the car running outside. I'll be running out after the gig's over. Sorry, you can send me a check. You don't have to pay me. You know, just
you travel light.
Very
you
know, light.
Just
remove,
you,
remove
you and the guitar and the
very,
exit.
Very quickly. Yeah. You know? And then there's other places where they don't get enough of it. You know, I was just playing. I played this great club, by the way, if anybody's listening up in Massachusetts, in Shirley, Massachusetts, which is about, half hour, 45 minutes outside of Boston, called the Bull Run. and it's just a great venue and has great people playing there. And we played there on this tour with shared the bill with a guy named Josh Williams, a good bluegrass player. And the politics up there are totally different. They're like cheering for I'm doing Don't Ask, Don't Tell can go to hell, and they're like cheering and putting their fists in the air. It's a whole different scene. New York. Well, funny thing is though, at the bitter end, I gave them hell for that because I said, I'm sitting here, Connecticut, Vermont, Iowa, they all passed pro gay marriage when it was up for vote. And I said, New York, you failed me. I moved to North Carolina, and this is what happens. New York doesn't pass gay marriage. That was like very surprising to me. However, the people at the bitter end both nights were very pro gay marriage. And like I said, I go along with my own adage there anyway. I think everybody should find out just how difficult marriage really is, so everybody should get to do it.
Oh, yes, at least once.
Yeah. So we'll see how many people I can offend with the new album.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. And actually, the reason I wanted to reconnect with you was because of a press release that I received. I heard you were headed for Canada.
Right.
And I just automatically assumed it would be Edmonton, from one score and ten. But no, that's not your plan. But tell us a little bit about your upcoming journey to the frozen north.
It's not cold enough in the States right now. I mean, Al Gore was definitely right. We have like some sort of a strange climate thing going on here. But Edmonton, much too cold. I'm crazy, and my agent is evil, but he's not that evil to send me to Edmonton in December. But I am going to Montreal and Ottawa. And Montreal is a gorgeous city any time of the year, even when it's cold. It's just a great place, great music scene, good sports town too if you're into going to see sports, and great restaurants. And so I was lucky enough to get booked there this Saturday night at Bistro de Paris. We'll be doing a concert there at, I believe, 8 o'clock the doors are open or something like that. And then going to Ottawa the next night at the Classic Elmdale House. I'll be performing there also at 8 o'clock on Sunday night in Ottawa, Canada. And also, just as a side note, I have relatives up there that I haven't seen in over 30 years that I'm going to reconnect with. So I'm excited about that. So come on out if you happen to be up there. It's a cold time of year to be going to Canada. I could have been booked in Cancun, but I chose Montreal.
Right. Do you and your agent get along well?
ask me when I come home on Monday. The crazy part was the original routing. People who fly a lot will appreciate this, because from Chapel Hill you can't go nonstop to Montreal. And the original routing had me going Raleigh to Chicago, Chicago to Montreal, and I was like, "What are you crazy?" So because Chicago O'Hare at this time of year, you might as well just figure that you're staying overnight because their flights just get canceled left and right. And I figured, but we changed that. I'm going through DC, so hopefully I'll just get up there with no problem.
Going back to One Score and Ten, on stage, is the song Edmonton still part of your set list?
Well, it's not part of my set list. I really haven't played it in years. It's more of a setup for another song on that album because, I wrote Edmonton and again, if you're an aspiring singer-songwriter and you want to get on the radio, write a song about a city that's never had a song written about it before, and they're just gonna and they'll love you, and you'll get the key to the city like I did, and all the tour and WestJet Airlines sponsoring me and all that stuff. But what I always say is I came back home to North Carolina, and everybody was like, okay, Toke, you know, you wrote the song about Edmonton. Now everybody thinks you're Canadian. And they said, well, you have to write a song about, you know, Carolina. And I was like, okay, nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina. And they said, nope, sorry, that one's taken. So,
Carolina on my mind.
Carolina on my mind for my homeboy James Taylor, who's from Chapel Hill. He wrote that one. So I was like, okay, that's not so good. And then so I came up with a song that's on that album, if you remember it, called Too Late for Me, Carolina, with a question mark, T-O-O, Late for Me, Carolina. And
right.
Actually borrowed some lyrics from that song, too. I was short on some lyrics. And I have a daughter. You remember a song from Love Won Out called Little Poetry Girl? I have a daughter who's an award-winning poet, and that song's written about her. So I happened to come across this folder of some of her old poems. So I sat there taking some of her lyrics and moved them into Too Late for Me, Carolina. So if you look at the liner notes very carefully on the One Score and Ten album, you'll see that there's a C.W. Rosenthal that got attribution and credit for some of the lyrics on Too Late for Me, Carolina, and that's my my oldest daughter. So,
yeah, I remember you telling me about that, and I thought it was just delightful.
So,
is she proud of her dad?
I hope she is, you know, but she did show up at the Bitter End shows, you know, which was nice. You know, she's good. She's in law school. That's my oldest daughter's in law school at NYU in New York, and her younger sister is a paralegal at a law firm. So they're sharing an apartment right now, and it's probably, I wish I just had the video rights to just videotape them. It would probably be a great sitcom or reality show with the two of them living together again after all of these years. But it's they're a source of inspiration.
You don't think it's a setup? She's about to sue you as soon as she becomes a full-fledged lawyer.
Well, states no. She's getting residual checks. She's doing good. It wasn't the biggest selling album I ever had, but she's making a few cents on airplay.
What would your average set look like, song-wise? You know, if it's just you and the guitar.
It's usually the thing I like about these tours also is, you know, I'm out there playing what we call listening clubs, which is very important to musicians. And, you know, so you're playing hour and 15-minute shows, which usually means it's 12 to 15 songs. You know, a little bit from each record and some of the new stuff that hasn't been recorded yet. And we sneak in the occasional cover. My background comes from boxing, so it's not unusual if any of my old fight fans or friends happen to be in the audience for me and Charlie to do The Boxer, the Simon and Garfunkel song, and normally we get the whole... we get the whole audience singing along on the la-da-la, la-da-la-la-la-la-la. So we do a whole thing, we'll sing along with that. And but otherwise, I don't want to give away too much. I want people to be surprised when they come out to the shows.
Sure,
but
you do tend to sample from all of your albums.
Yeah,
because, I mean, there's many musicians that... You know, we'll just play, you know, their current album and that's it.
Not at all. I love to play. I like playing, you know, the older stuff and mixing it up. And, you know, and as you do more, it's kind of interesting. When I first started touring, obviously the only original stuff I had was off of One Score and Ten. Now, as I'm I'm in the middle of recording a fourth album, it's kind of, you know, I have a pool of, you know, 40 or more original songs, so obviously they all can't get into the show, and they're all my babies. I feel guilty when I don't play them.
We're about to lose our live listeners, but we're not about to lose the recording. So can you tell us a little bit about the upcoming album?
It's tentatively titled The Librarian. And it's got songs, and I'll explain to you about the librarian part, and it's got songs from a song I wrote about the oil leak down in Louisiana, which is something that really...
Oh, I do want a copy of that.
It's just really, you know, bugged me to no end. There's another song I just... The last song that was written for the album, I literally wrote sitting in a rest stop on the Massachusetts Pike, heading towards Woodstock, New York, to meet my wife and daughters for Thanksgiving. And there was just this array of characters in the rest stop. And on my trip in general, because I'd made it, I'd left Charlie, lives in Concord, New Hampshire. The tour ended in Concord, consequently. So I left Charlie at his house and then drove from Concord, New Hampshire to Woodstock, New York. And all of these characters I met along the way, so they're part of the album. And it's been a fun trip putting this new record together.
When do you think we're likely to see it in the record stores?
We're saying the first week in May. So we'll see if it holds to fruition. You know, as long as there's no great obstacles, it should work out. It's an interesting thing. I've got there'll be like the usual cast of characters on the record, with Bobby Britt on fiddle, and Charlie will join me now playing mandolin, and Al Perkins on pedal steel guitar, Chris Stamey on bass, and also helping in the production of the record. But you'll love this story, and I'll leave you with this one. I was playing in a little town called, I think, Altrincham. You might know this town, Altrincham, outside of Manchester, in a little club there. And they told me that the opening act for me that night was going to be a group called Pancho Ballad and the Banditos. And, okay, Pancho Ballad and the Banditos. So we get there, and the group that's opening for me, it's a 7-piece band. They're all dressed like the Three Amigos in these Mexican outfits with the big hats. And they've got the brass section that's kind of like a mariachi brass section. But they're all British. There's not a Mexican in the band. Not even anybody who looks Mexican. But I got to tell you, they were great. And we became really good friends. They jammed... And I had alerted them by email prior to the gig. I said, by the way, you guys might want to think about covering or looking at the song from my first album, which is on my MySpace site, called The Ballad of Doc and Sadie, because it's got a Latin groove to it. So sure enough, when I got there, Pancho, who's the leader of the band, whose real name is Darren, Pancho comes up to me and he says, why don't we all, when you get done with your show, why don't we all come out and jam on Doc and Sadie? And I said, okay, great. And I figured, maybe they listened to it once or twice or something. So I get done with my show. I said, I'd like to bring out Pancho and the Banditos again. And they all come out on stage. And my wife, Carrie, comes up, and she's on maracas. And we all, start out to do the Ballad of Doc and Sadie. And they nailed it. They were so good. They had rehearsed it. They knew it note for note, and it has like the sharp ending at the end, and we all ended on the money, and it was like, I just looked around. I said, wow, these guys are great. This was fantastic. So there's two songs on the upcoming album that one of them screams out. I guess both of them kind of scream out for having this mariachi brass sound to it. So we're exchanging tracks. And they're going to be recording on the next album. So on two of the tracks, on The Librarian and a song called Who Was That Man? So I'm pleased to announce that Pancho and the Banditos will be on the next Tokyo Rosenthal album.
I am so looking forward to it. You have whet my appetite.
So.
Alas, our time... is at a close. Tokyo, I really want to thank you for taking time out to talk to us.
My pleasure as always, and looking, first of all, let me wish to you and yours and everybody listening happy holidays and a happy new year, and a lot of peace hopefully in 2011, and hopefully a lot of prosperity, although I don't want Mr. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the Great Depression to go out of style, but a lot of prosperity in 2011, and I hope to talk to you in May when the new record's out.
Oh, I'm sure we'll be talking before May.
All right.
Okay, till next time, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a great day. We'll be back again soon. Till next time, goodbye.